Double X is brought to you by MeUndies. MeUndies makes the world's most comfortable underwear in a variety of styles and patterns. Head to MeUndies.com/XX to get free shipping and 20% off your first order. And by BowlandBranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Order right now and they'll give you 20% off plus free shipping. Get sheets, towels, blankets, duvet covers, and more at BowlandBranch.com. That's B-O-L-L-A-N-D. BRANCH.com and use the promo code XX. And it's brought to you by Headspace. If you've ever been curious about meditation, then go to headspace.com/XX and try the Take 10 program, which is guided meditation for 10 days, 10 minutes a day, absolutely free. Give it a try at headspace.com/XX.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, February 25th, the free Kesha edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. I'm joined in the New York studios by Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
And today with us, we have Aisha Harris, culture writer at Slate. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
So where is June? Is she in Japan? Like, where did she go?
I think she's not in Japan yet. June has a very complicated month, right? She's going to Japan, but she's also very involved with some other work projects. June is missing. If you guys know where June is, please tell us.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend that June is on an international hunt for the best pencil. Mm-hmm. Like, she's going from country to country to see who makes the best pencil.
It's actually believable. I would watch that TV show, too.
Yeah, that was like a joke on Girls. How Shoshana went to Japan and was like, I got the best. Now I use a totally different pen.
You haven't referenced Girls in a while, Hannah, and I'm happy to see it coming back.
No, come on. I haven't referenced it because it hasn't been on television. Like, it's back on television, so I watched it last night, and there was a pencil joke. That's
there was.
All.
I liked that episode. It was a good episode.
What season is it on now? I stopped watching.
5, right?
It's
a final season.
Huh.
Okay.
Well, it was sweet. It was a wedding episode. You always have to open with a wedding episode. And I'm not talking about it because, like, I don't care.
Okay. Definitely not.
Definitely don't care. Okay. So our topics today, All the Single Ladies, a new book by Rebecca Traister and a cover in New York Magazine, argues for the single ladies as a new potent political class. Second, teenagers in America spend every second on social media and half the time it has something to do with sex, argues Nancy Jo Sales, both in Vanity Fair and her new book, American Girls, True or Not True. And then finally, Kesha versus Dr. Luke. The singer Kesha, is accusing her longtime producer of decades of abuse and a lawsuit that has suddenly become a symbol of female creative control. Okay, let's start with Single Ladies. All the Single Ladies, a new book by New York Magazine's Rebecca Traister, which is excerpted on the cover of your magazine, Noreen, this week, is the latest to argue that single ladies are a new class of worker, voter, and citizen, and that single women are taking up space in a world not designed for them. So I want to ask you guys a question as single ladies, because I don't count in this conversation. Neither does Rebecca, for that matter, because she's not single lady anymore.
That's true. Right?
Do you feel she's neutral about whether it's better to be single or married?
She very explicitly in the piece says, I'm not making a value judgment here. I'm just describing the new reality of America. And although she is married and has been married for 5 years, I think there's a part of Rebecca that seems to identify still with her single self, that it was so formative an experience to her, that she basically became an adult while not married. And a big part of her book is also about delayed marriage, right? It's not just that people, you know, are not married now. It's the idea that a lot of people will get married, but they're getting married later, with the result being that this is sort of the linchpin of her whole thing. The result being that for the first time in American history, there are more women at this present moment who are unmarried than there are women who are married, which is somewhat crazy.
Yeah. Maybe that's the whole point, what you just said, is if you stay single for longer and longer years in your adulthood, then the part of your identity that's single becomes stronger and stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't identify as Mrs. X and Y the way you used to.
Right. Right.
Psychically, you remain a single person even though you're married.
Well, okay, Hannah, you got married pretty young, relatively, right? have
not like relative to the earth, just relative to like you people now. Yeah,
right, right. In your in your mid 20s,
I was 27 when I got married, which sounds like a child now, but you know, but then it was like whatever.
But you don't think of yourself as Mrs. Plotz, right? Or do you?
Oh, fuck no, no, not Mrs. That is just like, that's a loaded question. Obviously not Mrs. Plotz, but like, do I identify with myself as a single or a married person? I don't know. Like, to me, marriage is not the big issue. It's more like the children, your work life. They're just, there seems to be other things that factor more into this than singleness.
I don't know. You say that as a person with a partner. I think navigating the world without a partner means you really do have a totally different perspective on things, which I think is what Rebecca's arguing here, is that single women, you know, up and down the socioeconomic ladder share some things in common.
Yeah. I would also say, to your point, Hannah, that was one of my questions while reading the New York Mag article, was kind of because she gets into these issues about how single women are sort of driving these issues about wage gaps and things like that. And there's a really powerful point towards the end of the article where she talks about how women still, like, marriage for them is not as validating with their career as it is for men. Men tend to still these days benefit more from getting married than women do. But my question was like, well, how does that factor in if you get married but like don't decide to have children? Like, that seems to me like a big, and I think she touches on it a little bit in the article, but that was sort of the question I had. Like, is marriage really the thing, or is it marriage as it relates to having children and singledom as it relates to having children? Is that more
of the
issue?
I felt that same way, like, in the whole Hillary argument, you know, like, why do millennials support Hillary? Mm-hmm. And then these women come back and they're like, wait until you are in the workplace for a few years. Like, Michelle Goldberg made this article. There was a New York Times op-ed this weekend. It's like, the only reason you young people don't understand Hillary is because you're not married yet. You haven't spent years in the workplace. And that's when you start to feel like, oh, I really am female, and being female really does suck in the public sphere. But I was, again, I'm not sure if that's because you're married or because you have children, or like, what, when exactly does the disillusionment happen?
Well, and in terms of what Aisha was just talking about now, I'm not positive that the data is quite disaggregated that much, but the figure that I remember from that just stuck out in my mind wildly is that for a college educated woman, for every year she's not married, her salary goes up by $18,000 over her married peer, which is crazy.
That was astonishing.
Like, yeah.
But why would that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, the children thing makes sense to me.
Right.
But why would being married affect anything about your life as a working person?
Well, like I said, I'm not sure that you know, compared single women without kids to married women without kids. You know, it might have been that, like, the balance of the women who are married did have kids by that point. Who knows? I think there are cases where sometimes women make career choices where they defer to their husband, you know. The other study that she talked about that I've seen used elsewhere is that Harvard Business School graduates, right? Like, the people who are sort of the most high achieving women you could in some ways possibly imagine in our culture, like the easiest group to study of that anyway, only 7% of them who were married said that their career was more important than their husbands, which is crazy. That's insane.
Than their husbands?
Yeah.
Or than their families?
No, let me pull this up, because that is, I want to make sure I got that right. Wait, hold on. Sorry.
Professor Noreen is rustling some papers in the background to get to
the
truth. All right,
I've found it, guys. And Hannah, this is your generation. Only 7% of female Generation X HBS graduates said they expected their careers to take precedence over their husbands. More than 60% of Gen X men surveyed said that they expected their careers to be the top priority. That's crazy.
Husbands?
I still don't
believe that.
Husbands.
Yeah.
Listen, we have a good fact-checking department in New York Magazine.
I mean, I guess that sort of, if I'm remembering correctly, reading Kate Bullock's article from a few years ago, All the Single Ladies, which is also sort of the same title as Rebecca Traister's book, All the Single Ladies.
But the books have a different title, right?
Right, exactly. The books have a different title. It's very confusing. Thank you, Beyonce. But basically, I think she says at one point that, like, her boyfriend, who she mentions at the beginning of the piece, who that she broke up with, like, moved across the country for her. And I wonder if that's sort of the precedence that, or the preference that they're trying to distinguish when they ask these Harvard Business School graduates, like, what does that mean to you in terms of, like, which do you take precedence over? Like, if you just take away the idea of having children, if it was just the two of you and one of you needed to move across the country for their job, would the other do that for you? Which I think, I don't know. I don't know how easy that is to measure, but maybe that is sort of another whole other factor to take into account when talking about women and how they do in the workplace, whether they're married or single.
Yeah. I also often think that even though Harvard Business, there's a bunch of business school studies that are often trotted out in these situations. And I actually think they're the worst example because business is so all or nothing. Like the kind of lesson about commitment to work that you learned at Harvard Business School is a little crazy. Hmm. So you really are making a pretty stark choice. Like, do I want to work a million hours a week or not? You know, as opposed to kind of creative class, it's like a little easier to kind of fudge it. Well, what do you guys think? Is that totally insane? Like, if any of your friends said to you, if 93% of your friends or whatever the statistic is said to you, like, yes, my husband is more important than my career, like, would you be like, not hanging out with you?
No, I think the people in your life should always be more important than your career.
If oh, they that's so Noreen.
Oh, come on. It's true.
Happy, loving answer.
But no, but if someone said to me, I think my husband's career is more important than my career, I can't picture actually a friend of mine saying that, to be honest. It's like kind of a foreign.
Yeah, it's unusual, yeah. Right? Like you wouldn't really think that someone would say that.
I don't think anyone would say that out loud. They might answer it in a survey, but to say it out loud to another woman, I think that'd be tough, man.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that I've ever... I've had conversations about this, and I don't think anyone of my friends would ever, my friends who are in relationships would say that about their significant others. I don't have too many close friends who are married yet, so.
Can I ask you if this is a live issue? Like, you don't have to answer in terms of yourself. You can say, like, among my friends. But, like, is it a live issue where you think, oh, I might think about getting married, but that's just going to mess up my life? Or does that mess up my career? Or does that conversation in your pure imagination or your friend's imagination happen around children? Or does it also happen around marriage?
Oh, I think around children. I also don't think it really... I think, you know, if you want to have kids, you want to have kids, and you're going to, that it becomes the most important thing, right? People certainly delay, but I don't think it's particularly unusual compared to the couple generations before. What I do think she's describing that's new is just the plurality of it, right?
Yeah.
And to me, the heart of the piece in her book is the idea that we all still live in this world that's set up for marriage, that's set up for partnership. And there's increasingly a gap between sort of the, you know, not just the cultural ideal, but also like the policy ideal. And that, you know, these women who on the upper end of things, right, if you're me, right, you're like a relatively well off privileged woman who makes more money because I have no children and whatever, like life's pretty good for me. If you have kids and you make a lot less money than I make, life's not great for you. And you're still, and then on top of that, you have the sort of psychic burden of being single and all that. And so all of these people are sort of lumped in as a class. And it's like a new class that's essentially, in some ways, being ignored.
And it's not, can I read the paragraph where she says that? Because it's my favorite paragraph in the piece and I outlined it and I have to think about it more. But she says, single women are taking up space in a world that was not designed for them. They make up a new republic, a new category of citizen. If the country's to flourish, we must make room for free women and let go of the economic and social systems built around the presumption that no woman really counts unless she's married. That was profound to me. That's interesting.
Yeah, totally profound to me, too. And I think it goes back to the conversation we keep having over and over again about Bernie and Hillary, which is another part of Rebecca's piece, which is that we're also shocked that people, that single women aren't identifying with Hillary. But what they are identifying is this more radical, you know, a sort of economic vision. And it makes sense if you're a person living in a world that's not, you know, the cookie cutter isn't cut in your shape, that you might want to break the mold a little bit more.
Yeah.
Dead into the room with that one.
No, it's not that. I really don't have a good grasp of, like, so therefore what? Like, what is she saying? What's an example of a policy that is designed, like a world that's designed for coupledom, like workplace rules? Like, but I'm only thinking of children, like the fact that we don't have childcare. I'm not thinking, like, what is it that single women need that they don't have?
I think that her argument comes back to the one that we've made a million times on this podcast, that sort of more humanistic government policies that allow for, you know, paid sick leave and paid family leave. Yes, they do, you know, sort of help specifically women with children most clearly, but also allow for just more freedom to be not assuming that there's another partner at home to take care of someone, right? It's not totally clear. Like, it's not totally clear what I, as single, childless woman, needs, you know, as a new policy from the government.
But that's the thing, right? It's not, I think from the whole piece, the thing that I gathered from it was that the single women who have the most power in terms of political power, at least according to Rebecca, seems to be the single women who have children and who have those things to worry about. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who are sort of galvanizing. And one thing that I do want to point out that I think she did a really good job of is enfolding, not just, this wasn't an article where single women by default meant white women. I mean, it's obviously the reason why we're talking about this mostly is the fact that white women are now a larger part of this than they were before. And previously, before that, single women, a lot of them were Black women and Latinas, minority women. And I think the fact that she folds that in and explains the differences and specifically explains why the reasons why up until now Black women were the ones who were so often identified as a single woman and didn't have a full political voice was because of all these sort of white powers that be that have prevented that from happening. And again, I think that all comes back down to single women who have children. Like, they are the ones who are driving this force.
Yeah.
That's so funny. That's, like, really confusing to me because I totally agree, like, the single mother thing, the reason it's come into our public conversation. But then I think it's about redefining the family. I see that's just, like, a different angle into it, is saying we have to have public policy which deals with single women, whereas I was always thinking we have to have public policy that understands that a family can be any kind of thing, like basically ride the coattails of the gay rights movement and be like, look, this is a family too, like two people living together with a kid, one person living there with a kid, a mom and a kid, that's a family, like write workplace policies to be humane to them too. Mm-hmm.
That's the ideal, I think, but I don't necessarily think that that's what's happening. And I think that's kind of what she might be getting at as well.
So has she convinced you guys to stay single forever?
I don't think that's the point. I mean, I'm in a long-term relationship. I basically consider myself married, but I'm not legally. But I also don't ever plan on having children. So, like, to me, it doesn't have any... I could be single, I could be married, it doesn't matter. Like, I'll have my partner, hopefully, for as long as I live, and we'll go from there.
And you don't have, like, do you have a philosophical objection to marriage, or you're just not married? You haven't, it's not like, it just hasn't happened.
I guess I sort of have I'm of that, the sort who thinks it's a nice idea, but I also see it more so as, like, a contract than anything else. I don't have any, like, wild notions about being, like, I don't plan on calling myself a wife or my boyfriend a husband. Like, there's that whole issue. So, I'm more or less ambivalent about marriage.
As the child of a lawyer, I'm going to tell you that contracts can sometimes be a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, Noreen, get a contract. That's what you say? That's what all our listeners should do?
I think that's Beyonce's next song.
If you like it, then you should have get a contract.
I got a bright future as a songwriter.
It's not quite working. Okay, well, let's move on to our next subject, teens and social media. But before we do that, let's hear from our first sponsor.
The XX Gabfest is sponsored this week by MeUndies. Whether you're wearing a suit or sweats, oh, I would love to be wearing sweats right now, you spend almost 24 hours a day in your underwear. But instead of making a statement like Superman's tights under his everyday clothes, your underwear is probably boring. MeUndies is here to change that. So every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal, which, if you don't know modal, it's a fabric that's apparently twice as soft as cotton. And when you try them on, you can definitely feel that. They are super, super soft. And the great thing about MeUndies is that you get to sort of try them out. If you don't love them, they're free. How often can you say that about underwear? It's sort of the only thing that you cannot really try on and return. So shipping is free in the United States and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with their subscription plan. So that's pretty fun, just getting underwear delivered to your home. So you can get the subscription or a single pair. And either way, you can have 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/XX. That's MeUndies.com/XX. All right, now back to the show.
So our next topic, teens and social media. Vanity Fair writer Nancy Jo Sales has a new book called American Girls, full of terrifying stories of 13-year-olds who spend every second on their phones taking sexy pictures, getting super anxious that someone else's picture is sexier, and then sometimes actually arranging with dirtbag older guys how to meet them and presumably have actual sex. Okay, Nancy Jo Sales has been writing about this for a long time, and I've actually wanted to talk about this for a long time. What did you guys, give me a first impression of what you thought of these stories. Like, were there moments when you read her stories on Vanity Fair? She collects many more in the book and thought like, oh shit, this is really, really different from when I was 13, 14, 15.
So I'm of two minds. One is, yeah, it is pretty different. And I have often had the thought as a like full grown adult who feels like social media takes over my psyche more than I wish it did, that I'm glad I'm not growing up in this era. On the other hand, she's super scaremongery and sort of cherry picks the worst examples, you know, And a lot of what she describes seems to be just sort of typical teen behavior. The only difference now is that adults have a way to sort of listen in on it, right? Like, teenagers have been getting drunk and being, you know, a little loose forever and saying dumb things. You never say dumber things in your life than when you're a teenager. The problem now is that it's, you know, typed on the screen where adults have a way to listen in.
Yeah, I definitely felt like, it kind of reminded me of when I was a teenager or a child in the 90s. I'm only 28 now. And I remember in school, in elementary school, they would show us these videos taped from like Dateline or Nightline, where they were very fear-mongery. Like, these are teens hanging out and doing drugs and going to raves, and like there's glow sticks everywhere, and like kids are convulsing on the floor. And it just felt just as sort of hyped up and overwrought in a way that didn't feel like it accurately represented the way most teens interact.
Yeah.
And I also grew up like in this weird, like, Facebook didn't exist until like my very first year of freshman year of college. Before that, we did have, you know, AIM, instant messaging. So like there were plenty of ways for like us to do the same things that are being done with these girls, with the exception of like texting pictures wasn't really a thing, but like you could email a picture of yourself. Like,
yeah. And also I think maybe there was no more dangerous era for the internet than the early days of like AOL chat rooms.
Oh, for sure.
I did not really do this, but I had friends who did, and like people would just, you know, message older men. And I feel like now it's mostly teen to teen, but before it was like, anyone on the internet, come talk to me, you know?
Oh, I would get tons of, like, in the early days of AOL Instant Messenger or AOL chat rooms, like, I would get messages from random people all the time. Thankfully, you know, I was not inclined to answer them, and my father was also very, like, strict about making, like, watching my internet intake. But, I don't know, that seemed like a scarier time than now.
Yeah, and we all grew up, most of us, pretty fine. I don't know. Hannah, you have a teenage daughter. So I wonder if you, and you've also reported around some of these same issues yourself, right? So I'm interested.
Yeah, I'm mostly stuck on the idea that, like, how come only my mom contacted me on AOL Instant Messenger? Like, what's wrong with me? It's only my mom who has AOL.
It was just such a weird time because you were so excited for like any kind of internet thing to happen. You were like, all right, cool.
Well, before I launch in, because I'm just not into this like hysterical reporting about 13-year-olds. And yes, I've done my own reporting and it's like, well, I'll say what I think in a minute. I want to say first, the one thing I think is different than other periods is the visuals, like the constant one-upping on the visuals, like the way I'm not saying this is the same as like predation or like, you know, the amount of sex teens have has not gone up. Like the age of first sex, in fact, has gone up. I mean, all the statistics show that this doesn't actually have an effect on behavior out like in real life. But that does like that does make me anxious, like that This American Life story recently called Status Check, I think, where they started with all those teenage girls talking about how every single second they're on Instagram. I think they were the Instagram girls. Snapchat was a recent BuzzFeed story where some guy's sister was teaching him how to use Snapchat. And it's like every second, you know, and it's like the pictures are up there every second. So that seems stressful, like the amount of kind of psychic energy. It's mostly girl on girl is the way it's portrayed in these kind of in the, you know, when you get like actual like words of teens talking about what their life is like. I don't know. That's like a bit that is different.
Well, that's a definite choice that she made, was to focus only on teenage girls, which in her very good review of the book on Slate, Amanda Hess points out that there is sort of an imbalance here. You sort of only hear from the boys when they're sort of commenting on the girls' bodies, or if she just needs, you know, a quote from a guy and she can't find the girl, she'll quote him. But
I'm not talking about the Nancy Jo Sales book. I'm talking
just
about
in general.
Like it does.
So
seem
you think
like
it's harder
general.
On girls than boys?
I think that one little thing of having the visual, like having to visually present yourself constantly as a way of being socially relevant, seems slightly different than in other eras and pretty stressful. Like, it's not that it isn't always stressful to be a teenage girl and go to school and be like, who's skinnier than me, who's prettier than me. But the idea of having to like post pictures constantly, endlessly, and compare and get likes, that's like a full time job.
Oh,
whenever
yeah.
you hear these teens talk about it, it's stressful.
I can't imagine trying to develop a sense of self-worth in that kind of world. Like, it just, it seems awful.
Yeah, I agree that that aspect of it is the part that does worry me, less so than the sexual nature of it, just this sort of constant. I mean, I remember being very glued to AIM as a kid, but that was only when I came home from school. Like, I didn't have a cell phone.
Yeah.
So it was, you go home and you go on AIM and you like wait for someone to message you or wait to see if like the guy you like is online, and then you message him. But now that it's we all have cell phones and we all have these alerts that pop up, that is something that seems to worry me about contributing to these kids' like anxious anxiety about like presenting themselves in a way that gets them even more likes and more attention.
And also the way they pose is just completely derivative, right? It's like, oh, they're just posing from like what was in a video. Like they don't, it's not like, it doesn't feel natural in any way. It just feels like mimicking poses on
yeah.
music videos, you know?
So it seems to me like there are two sort of separate issues and that they've been conflated together. One is like, are kids doing more bad stuff now? And actually, there's a ton of data that shows the opposite. Vox did a big piece a few weeks ago that I found sort of stunning, where you could plug in the year you were born and compare yourself or your cohort to teens today. And, you know, they all do like 70% fewer drugs, like 50% fewer pregnancies. I made up those stats, but it was like they were like big, big differences, basically arguing or showing that kids today are much more sort of careful. But then you've got this whole separate, more troubling, harder to measure psychological thing that I think we can all agree is a little alarming, but all keeps getting lumped in together. That you can't,
right.
you can't just see the psychological problems of it as their own problem. You have to like lump them in with acting out. And sometimes people don't act out, you know, it just is an inward thing.
All right. So my problem with the Nancy Jo Sales approach is that she basically gets the same story like in different locations. right? It's like you talk to people in the kind of 1 second that you talk to them. They talk about all the things that stresses them out about social media. She then makes that the single narrative about teenage girls and social media. And then weirdly, like, they live inside that narrative. It's like, because they read the media. And so she's almost part of the problem. It's like this self-perpetuating story, which doesn't go any deeper than that. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I did my story about sexting for The Atlantic, they're just like shades. There's all sorts of ways, like some of the girls feel exploited. Some of the girls are totally like, this is my body, I'm putting my picture up. You know, there's a lot about the boys. Some of the boys are shy and like interact a little bit. Some of the boys are dicks, or at least they just act that way, you know, in a kind of like braggy 15-year-old boy way. There's just like many ways that people dip in and out of social media. And the idea that like all of teenage girldom is destroyed by social media, it's just like not that convincing, you know?
Yeah. And she sort of caught a lot of flack for a recent piece she did on Tinder and online dating, where she also went to sort of the worst case scenario over and over again, without looking at sort of the more, you know, the more usual user experience.
Well, I don't even think the worst case scenario isn't true. I just think it's a part of the experience.
Right. I'm like a student of Nancy Jo Sales's work. Like, I loved her stuff. She wrote a lot for New York Magazine in the 90s, and like really sort of fun pieces. Like, she wrote this really classic piece called Prep School Gangsters of rich New York City kids who were, you know, trying to become drug dealers, essentially. And The Bling Ring, which she wrote just a couple years ago. All of these pieces are really sort of like tightly written, detail chalked, really fun pieces. And then she's sort of taken on this second life in her books as kind of almost a pundit, like a
Broad social commentary.
Yeah. Right. And it's right. Like, and I think her magazine editors, either she's developed a taste for this because she herself has a teenage daughter or whatever, or her editors were taking it out. But I just want her to go back to the old mode of just like scene.
Well, The Bling Ring is kind of awesome. Like, whatever you think about her particular reporting on her, the movie, it's just like an awesome location for the extremes that she's clearly attracted to. Like, she likes the extremes, right? And so you find a group of kids who are living in the extreme, and then it's just like fabulous to watch them do their thing and be like obsessed with celebrity culture. And you can see all the themes that she's talking about in this book are just like alive in The Bling Ring. But as broad social commentary, it's like, I don't know. Like, you ever met a teenage kid like and talk to them for more than, you know, an hour? Like, that conversation lasts an hour, and then there's the next conversation.
Yeah. So I read the magazine article, The Bling Ring, and then I read the book, and the book had the broad social commentary written in. Like, this is what wealth does to, you know, blah, 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 and this is what social media does. And it was just kind of a drag.
Right.
No other way to put it.
Right. So skip the social commentary.
Yeah, who needs that?
Who needs that?
Don't listen to us.
Yeah, exactly. Go back to the extremes. Okay, well, we are going to move on to Kesha and Dr. Luke. Before we do that, we'll hear from our next sponsor.
The XX Gabfest is also brought to you by Bowl and Branch. So there's one important thing you can do to help ensure having a good day, and that's getting a good night's sleep the night before. My mother always told me that, and she's right. One company has set out to make this possible. It's Boll & Branch. They've reinvented sheets and bedding with the sole purpose of making your nights more comfortable than ever. Boll & Branch is a company to try out. Their bedding is so soft, it'll be a new standard of comfort that you'll measure everything else by. And there is no better feeling than just sort of being enveloped in cozy sheets, especially this time of year. It's February, it's cold, it's rainy, it's dreary. It's the kind of weather that you want to spend some quality time just kind of hibernating in, and Boll & Branch can help you do that. So bollandbranch.com, where you know you're paying for quality sheets and not department store overhead. You're getting amazingly luxurious sheets for a couple $100. So go online to Boll, that's B-O-L-L and branch.com. And they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights, which is a pretty good deal. And it gets even better because you can also go to bollandbranch.com today for 20% off your whole order, which can be sheets, it can be towels, blankets, duvet covers, the whole shebang. And you get free shipping. So all their products come beautifully packaged in their signature boxes, which is another bonus. So bollandbranch.com today for 20% off your entire order. And use the promo code XX, D-O-U-B-L-E-X, at bollandbranch.com. All right, back to the show.
And our last topic, Kesha and Dr. Luke. they've been embroiled in a longtime lawsuit. A ruling came down last Friday, which was interpreted as being against Kesha. I guess it is against Kesha. This is just a little complicated to explain. We'll get into it in a moment. But let's just say for now, it's become a big deal, both about sexual assault and creative control for female artists. Okay, I think you guys, we kind of have to explain before we get going on the meaning, right? So who wants to take a stab at explaining, well, why don't we explain the history first of Kesha and Dr. Luke, because that's actually kind of interesting. Aisha, do you want to take that one?
I can attempt.
Like a brief history of the relationship starting with 18-year-old Kesha and however old Dr. Luke was at the time, 30s, mid-30s, when he met her.
Right. So Jezebel actually has had a piece up that sort of broke down the background that I found useful for kind of parsing through all of this. So I'm going to sort of draw from what that Jezebel article, which is called She Was Proving Hard to Control, which is a quote that apparently said in a book about Dr. Luke.
So, I thought it was from that New Yorker story, which was so interesting.
Oh,
we'll get to that later.
Yeah, maybe it was.
It was a John Seabrook New Yorker piece that he then expanded into a larger book about the production of pop music that had a big section on Dr. Luke.
Oh, okay,
got it.
Okay.
So
it was like a 2013 profile of Dr. Yeah. Luke, which had lots of interesting stuff, which we'll get to.
Right.
But go ahead.
So I've already gotten that part mixed up. But,
no, it was okay. A book. You were right.
It's so confusing. So basically, I guess Kesha and Dr. Luke, she met him around the time of when she was 18. And she had her foot sort of in the door of the music business, but wasn't quite there yet. Met Dr. Luke, wrote the hook for the song Right Round, which was performed by who's the then kind of up and coming rapper Flo Rida.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I didn't want to say anything, but.
Flo Rida, play on Florida. And she wrote the hook, but then, like, for whatever, he, like, didn't credit her on the song. And she also sang the hook. And he didn't credit her on the song, so she didn't get any sort of royalties for that. But at the same time,
That happened first, before she was a pop star? I thought that was, like, a later diss.
No,
that was, like, her first experience. That's awful.
Yeah, that was her first. Like, I remember when that song came out, and I didn't even realize that, like, Kesha was on
it. Right.
Because, again, like, she's not credited. So he liked her music and whatever. And so he convinced her apparently to, she was on her way. She had done really good in school and she was on her way to go to college. And he convinced her to drop out or not go to college and to instead sign with him. And so she signed with him and eventually things started to get a little icky. A year or so went by where, like, he didn't do anything to promote her career. She got frustrated. I think she briefly moved to another company to represent her, but then went back to Dr. Luke. And then things started to get icky, according to Kesha, sort of in a sexual way. He would say things to her about his wife and the fact that he would brag about, like, being able to take home any woman he wanted.
Yeah, it's like there's a simultaneous creative control story and a sexual emotional abuse and control story. It's like older guy controls young artist in various ways. Like, one is trying to lock her into being a kind of pop star that she's trying to get away from, like the kind of generic party girl. He even has a term, like, people like the generic party girl. Like, he tries to put most girls into the generic party girl pop star mode, and she's trying to do a more rock and roll album. He's not into it. This is where the she's proving difficult to control comes in. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole other narrative that involves, like, specific incidents that Kesha lays out, which are about sexual, like, making moves on her. Like, he was so threatening when she visited him at his house that she ran on the highway in her bare feet.
Drugging
just like
her.
Stuff like that. Like, drugging her, right. There's, like, a Bill Cosby story in there too of, like, drugging her on an airplane and then assaulting her on the plane. So there's just, like, a long history of control and then specific incidents of sexual abuse.
So we should just also clarify a little bit with the lawsuits that there are two separate lawsuits that are sort of in question. One, the first one was filed by the management company that she was briefly signed with before going back to Dr. Luke. And Kesha and her mother both testified in that basically favorably towards Dr. Luke.
Well,
the company,
maybe.
Well, maybe. That's not unsealed yet, but it seems like they didn't whatever they testified, it was not enough to bolster the other.
Wait, but there's like video clips. That one is, that's like a problem for this new case, because when they're taking her testimony and it's on video, they specifically ask her, like, did you ever have any intimate relations with him? No.
Right.
There was another question they asked.
Is that new? When did that
come
up?
Did he ever drug her? No, they're old. It's like they're from another case. So you could argue that
in
that case.
This is a 2010 case.
Yeah. Like in that case, she was actually trying to, if she had interest in maybe like fudging towards Dr. Luke.
And that was a time when her career with Dr. Luke was going really well. She was either on her first or second hit record. Anyway, so then flash forward to 2014, which is when she sort of brought these more serious allegations against Dr. Luke, and in a civil suit, not a criminal suit, right? So that's become a point of some contention, which is that some people are saying, oh, why didn't she or her mother go to the police if she woke up, thought she'd been, you know, raped or violated in some way? And so there's sort of a very cynical view that she's trying to get out of this 6-record-long contract that in which the terms of the deal are unfavorable to her. And the judge ruled against her and her mother in this case, in part citing her testimony.
The judge didn't like totally rule against her. This was an injunction. This was her saying, can we just suspend this so I can keep making records outside of Sony? So it wasn't like resolving the case.
Right.
It was saying like, this is so urgent. Can you just let me out of this contract so I can keep making music and then we'll keep on with the lawsuit? And the judge said, no, I can't. You can't be, you're not released from this contract.
Right. And it seems as if the judge had sort of truly believed the allegations that she's making, the judge might have let her out of the deal. Because it, you know, imagine being forced to work with your assaulter. And what the record company, what Sony's arguing, is that Kesha can continue to work with another producer. She does not have to work with Dr. Luke. It's all very, very complicated. But what interests me is the way that it's been received in the culture. There were some photographs of Kesha weeping when this judge's ruling and the injunction came down that sort of went viral. A bunch of celebrities, largely, you know, female pop stars, have tweeted or Instagrammed their support of Kesha. Taylor Swift went so far as to donate $250,000 to Kesha, to Kesha's sort of legal defense fund. And to me, it sort of marks a shift in, you know, sort of people automatically, not automatically, but the balance of belief seems like it goes towards the woman.
Yeah, for at least for some of the pop stars. I mean, the one interesting thing about this whole sort of show of support has been particularly Demi Lovato, the pop star, sort of went off on this sort of subtle digging tweet spree, where she claimed that so-called self-proclaimed feminists like weren't speaking up. A lot of people were quick to jump on that and wonder, oh, is she referring to Taylor Swift? Because Taylor Swift has kind of in the last couple of years made that her mantra of like, I'm all for feminism. And people have questioned like what kind of feminism she's all for. Is it feminism for everyone or feminism for herself? Kind of the same things that pop stars like Beyonce and Rihanna have also been accused of. And then so when Taylor decided to make a show of paying the $250,000, the question was like, was this planned already or was this in response to Demi? And to me, like the response in that sense was kind of icky, just the way that Demi Lovato sort of made it into like who's the better feminist in a way that.
But
sort
when
of took
did that happen? Like when did was that?
That
like,
happened I this weekend. Been, this
no,
past
no, no,
weekend.
But I mean, like that in the culture. Like I thought in the last few years, it's like people backing off. Like all the stories you read are like, I'm not a feminist.
No.
I don't like that word. I'm not a feminist. And now it's like,
well, Beyonce,
be a damn feminist.
Feminism is cool now.
Yeah.
But the more interesting thing to me about the Taylor Swift move, actually, is that Taylor Swift is someone who's been really smart about maintaining control of her business. And she and Kesha seem like they're just at polar opposite ends of that. You know, Taylor Swift was signed very young. It seems like her parents were pretty savvy about how to structure all this. And she, as an adult, has been a really super savvy businesswoman. And so that was sort of interesting to me as a study in contrast. You know, like there is a long, long, long history of the pop and movie world sort of taking advantage of female stars, and the people behind the scenes are the people with all the power, largely men. And Taylor was taking her money that she had earned with her better structured contracts and giving it to someone who didn't have, you know, that sort of smart deal.
Yeah, I think that's the subtext here, is like that there was an old way of doing things and now we're all getting on board with a new way of doing things. I mean, it's almost like Kesha's become a cautionary tale, because I'm not sure what you said is true, Noreen, that it's decided, like we're at that Cosby moment that you wrote about on your New York Magazine cover, where like everybody is solidly behind the women. I feel like the chatter goes both ways about Kesha.
Well, yeah,
it's like believe Kesha, don't believe Kesha. Like we're kind of in the Rolling Stone moment around Kesha.
Well, it's just a more complicated situation because there's clear financial benefit for Kesha if she wins her case. And with something like the Cosby case in particular, if we're going to draw that comparison, there wasn't that same thing.
I think there's also another element here of like, if it wasn't Kesha, if say it was someone else who was speaking up about this, someone like Rihanna or even Britney Spears, who like hasn't been relevant in about 10 years, but like, I think...
Hey, come on.
I love Britney, but she has not been relevant. She plays in Vegas now, like whatever.
Work Bitch was such a good song. Come on, man.
Anyway, if Britney had come forward and said, this happened to me, Dr. Luke had raped me, I feel like the conversation, because a lot of what I see, and granted, internet chatter is internet chatter, it's not the be-all and end-all, but, like, internet chatter is still, like, these are things that people actually believe. And a lot of people are talking about Kesha. They don't believe her. They say, like, oh, she's just doing this for money. And I think part of it is that Kesha was never sort of, like, quote-unquote, America's sweetheart. She was never, like, this beloved, innocent figure in the way that someone like Britney Spears was ostensibly supposed to be. She came out, like, Kesha's first song, like, the very first lyrics of her hit was, like, wake up in the morning and brush my teeth with a bottle of Jack or something like that. And so...
Which everybody plays in the news story. Like, every little news story has that little clip.
Right. It's like, she's, like, the bad girl. So it's like, she must have, like, wanted it. Or there's this, like, this undercurrent of people. I agree with you, Hannah, that, like, I'm not sure that we're completely, I think it is different that we have all of these female pop stars coming forward, but I think, and that's powerful, but I also think that we have, this is not necessarily, I think, akin to the Cosby moment, where it's like everyone who's in their right mind believes this woman's story. And if she had been a different pop star, I think it would be a little bit different.
What weirds me out, to twist this one step further, do you read the Dr. Luke profile and you're like, oh, Dr. Luke manufactures these girls. Like, poor Kesha at 18 kind of got stuck in this image that Dr. Luke created for her, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, the creepiest part to me of that profile is when he's talking about Becky. Right after talking about Kesha, he talks about Becky G, who was then 16, who sings that song Shower. And here's what he says about Becky G. He says, Becky G's a very nice, respectful girl who's brought up right by her parents with solid values. She's also easy to work with, which is not always the case with rappers. So it's like he takes these, you know, he like wants these girls who are like innocent, easy to work with, i.e. easy to control. And then he turns her into Becky G of the Shower video, which is not like quite Kesha. She's not like brushing her teeth with Jack. It has like a little innocence to it, but it's like the bridge towards Kesha.
Yeah,
you know?
he's a Svengali. He's
right. But Svengali makes it sound like cool and like he.
I think it has a dark tone to it. Anyway, the free Kesha hashtag actually started as a commentary on her like artistic, you know, her wanting to go more in a rock direction and less in a like pop kind of glorifying skankiness direction.
But that's the profound thing. It's like there's the one model, which is like Beyonce, Taylor Swift, like I'm controlling my own creative direction. And then there's this other model of like Svengali manufactures young teenage girl pop stars. Right. And so like we all vote for option one, you know, right? Yay.
Yeah.
Creative control. We're all for creative control. We'll wrap it up there. So let's move on to our recommendations. But before we do that, let's hear from our third sponsor.
The Double X Gabfest is also brought to you by Headspace. Headspace is a meditation app. As you may know, most of your problems start with your mind, start and stop with your mind sometimes. This can be fear, it can be anger, it can be stress, it can be anxiety, depression, sleeplessness. All of these are problems. that, you know, are in your head, but they can spiral out. They can really affect your life. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can make a major difference. You can combat them on your own in just 10 minutes a day with guided meditation. So what you do is you download the new Headspace app, and Headspace is meditation made simple. I have never meditated. It's one of these things that I've always meant to try, and I don't. I do yoga, which is sort of like approaching meditation, but not getting you all the way there. And this might be the year that I really go whole hog and try it out. So one thing that's really great about Headspace is that it's guided. And so you don't have to just sit there totally alone with your thoughts. It sort of walks you through it. And you can do it wherever you want, on your phone, on your computer, on your tablet. You can meditate on the New York City subway, which I've seen people doing, and really seems like kind of a great way to pass your commute. And it's really, really popular, actually. Over 4 million users are already using Headspace. So to try it out, you can download the free Headspace app and begin their Take 10 program, which is 10 days of guided meditation at headspace.com/XX. And it's completely free. So to train your mind for a healthier, less stressed life, start your free trial today at headspace.com/XX. That's headspace.com/XX.
Okay, well, let's move to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
Well, I was so excited about this one because I thought it was more interesting than my usual ones. And then I was listening to the Culture Gab Fest on the way over here, and I realized that this is the second week in a row someone on that show has endorsed this. So I am way behind the curve. But I went to see all of the Oscar animated shorts, Oscar nominated animated shorts. And I'd never done that before. It was so fun.
It's so much fun to do that.
Yeah. And I think I saw it at BAM, and I think there are other places you can see it. I think you can watch most, if not all of them online. But I was a little bit skeptical because I'm not a big sort of cartoon person. But they were all this combination of dark, but very, I don't know, a lot of them were about animals, but they were very human, if that makes any kind of sense. And you should just do it. They're short. They're great.
Excellent. I almost saw them like 7 times during that snowy weekend, and then I just never quite made it because they're like 2 hours and 45 minutes. But you're like the 5th person who told me.
It's worth amazing. It. It's worth it.
Okay, well, I'm going to recommend a podcast. I'm sorry, since I'm newly in this world, I'm like listening to all these new podcasts that all the NPR youth send my way, and one of them is so awesome. It's called Shortcuts. It's a BBC radio one. It's like the kind of other coast version of How This American Life Works, and it's hosted by this British comedian named Josie Long, and it's so awesome. It's like personal. Like, it makes This American Life seem almost formal. You know, it's like very nostalgic and memory driven, but also kind of disconnected stories over one theme. And I just listened to one called Wild Water, which is a story both about like a refugee swimming across the ocean and also a pool party. And it's just fabulous. Aisha, what do you have?
I'm going to recommend American Crime, the TV show. So not American Crime Story, the O.J. Simpson miniseries, but the John Ridley-penned American Crime, which comes on ABC. I have not watched the first season, which had a completely different narrative. It's also an anthology series. But this season now, with Felicity Huffman and Andre 3000 of Outkast and Regina King, just really fascinating. The basic premise is a boy at a prep school goes to a party and is presumably drugged and then thinks he might have been raped. And it unfolds this narrative so interestingly from all these different perspectives of the school and how it tries to handle it and tries to avoid, like, embroiling all the... Oh, by the way, it involves athletes and a basketball team. And so it deals with the politics of, like, athletes and a school trying to protect itself. And then also the point of view of the kids. And then there's race. And I think it's just doing a really good job of trying to connect all of these dots and make it as complex and rich as possible. And it feels very timely, and just the acting is amazing. So that would be my recommendation.
That sounds awesome. That sounds like completely my kind of thing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Aisha, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Noreen, as always.
Thanks, Anna.
Thanks to our fabulous producer, Anne Hepperman. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Networks, and our intern is Shiva Bayat. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. For more information on the show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX. Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabFest. Thank you for those who have liked us, and more of you are coming on the Facebook page to chat, and we love it. Email is XXGabFest@slate.com, or you can subscribe on iTunes or any place where you can get podcasts. For Aisha and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk again in 2 weeks. Now put your hands up in a club, just
broke up. I'm doing my own little thing. Hey, this is Eric Molinsky, the host of the newest podcast on Panoply, Imaginary Worlds. Every other week, I explore different sci-fi fantasy genres, how they're created, and why we suspend our disbelief. You could start at the beginning with what makes a good origin story, whether you're applying for a job or starting out as a new superhero. You could also check out my 5-part series on Star Wars, where I looked at how the evil empire became a metaphor in sports and politics, and whether Princess Leia's gold bikini is a feminist icon. Imaginary Worlds gives you the backstory behind pop culture stories and how they've changed the way we understand the real world. You can subscribe in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.